This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Maurice Sendak, artist, author, children's book illustrator, costume and set designer, turned 80 this summer. The 92nd Street Y in New York is honoring his birthday with a celebration on Monday, featuring performances, readings, and commemorations. Sendak also is being saluted through next May with a rotating exhibition featuring hundreds of his works at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia. Today we'll listen back to two of Terry's conversations with Maurice Sendak, starting with this one, when she spoke with him in 1993 after the publication of his book We Are All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy. It was his first children's book that wasn't about middle-class kids. We Are All in the Dumps deals with homelessness, sickness, and hunger. It's based on two English nursery rhymes. Terry asked him to recite them.
We are all in the dumps, for diamonds are trumps. The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. The babies are bit, the moon's in a fit, and the houses are built without walls. That's the first one. Second one. Jack and Guy went out in the rye, and they found a little boy with one black eye. Come, says Jack, let's knock him on the head. No, says Guy, let's buy him some bread. You buy one loaf and I'll buy two, and we'll bring him up as other folk do.
The first rhyme that you recited,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have known what to make of it. I'd have to say, it wouldn't have made any sense to me. You want to recite it one more
sure.
time?
Sure. Well, see, there are clues in it for an illustrator. We are all in the dumps,
mm-hmm.
for diamonds or trumps. The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. The babies are bit, the moon's in a fit, and the houses are built without walls. Now, I think it's extraordinarily beautiful poetry, but it's like haiku. What does it mean? Well, I'm faced with a bridge game, diamonds or trumps. That means somewhere in this book somebody's playing bridge. Not being a card player, that doesn't turn me on. So I had to learn how to play bridge. The moon's in a fit. You have to figure out why the moon is in a fit. What does it mean? The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. I mean, what does St. Paul's mean to American children primarily? And then the astonishing, extraordinary line, the houses are built without walls. I mean, that's what moved me all these years to make this work for me.
So what did that come to mean to you, the houses are built without walls?
It meant, finally, kids who have no place to live. This really started back in Los Angeles, or at least one detail, and a significant one, began in Los Angeles years ago. I was working on an opera, the LA Opera, and we came home late from a rehearsal, and I was driven back to my hotel, and we passed down some very, very posh streets in Beverly Hills. Maybe it was Rodeo Drive, but I couldn't swear to it. And there, past midnight, on the street, in this posh section of town, was just a dilapidated, ruined cardboard box with two dirty, naked kids' feet sticking out. The juxtaposition was astonishing. It's as though when everybody stopped shopping and gone home, then these kids came out, or people came out, and every city is ringed round with shantytowns, homeless. We all know that. We have it in New York. We have it in every major metropolis in this country. But it astonished me to see that juxtaposition. I got interested, and I got a book on Rio de Janeiro, and discovered that there is a ringed round, well-known shantytown, kids town around the city. And kids are abandoned there. Little girls sold into prostitution, little boys run away from abuse, from being abused at home, and they make their own cities, and they're as cruel to each other as any adults can be, and their lives are very, very brief. And they live in tin cans and cardboard houses and rag huts, and I suddenly began to see what dumps is. We are all in the dumps. Back in the 60s, that of course meant, you know, if you're in therapy, dumps means you're in a depression, which is probably why I couldn't make anything sound out of it back then. Now dumps literally means the world. We are all in the dumps is really well describes events around the world at this point.
Maurice Sendak, speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. Let's jump to a later part of his conversation with Terry. She asked him about his parents, both of whom were immigrants to America.
Now, they were from Poland?
They were from Poland, yeah.
And they fled before World War One.
Yes, they did, just before World War One. They didn't flee. My father left on a lark.
Oh, well, what was that?
He had no cause to come here. My grandfather was a rabbi. He was the youngest son, and he was obviously the spoiled younger son of my grandmother. And he actually fell in love with a young woman. And it became a little bit scandalous, and she was put on a boat and shipped off to America. And he sulked and pouted and got money out of his siblings and got on another boat to follow her here. And his family was appalled at his behavior. Because of that trivial behavior, he was the only survivor of his entire family. I mean, all of my uncles and aunts and all of the children were destroyed in concentration camps. My father's grief for his entire life was that his survival was based on such a trivial impulse. It really did cause him a lot of grief, especially when he became older.
Did your parents talk to you much about the old country?
Oh, yeah. Thank goodness. And when my father was last year of his life, paradoxically, we had a wonderful time, I took his biography down, which was wonderful. A lot of it was fantasy and a lot of it was reality, but I was...
His biography?
Yeah.
He
wrote a biography, which is not published. He did write a fairy tale, which I translated with the help of somebody else and illustrated, and that was published just before his death. But his biography is not published, and I don't intend to have it published. It's a private family chronicle. We didn't get much of my mother's life. My mother was silent about that period of her life.
I think as a lot of people from Eastern Europe who came to America were. Did they seem like aliens to you because, I don't know, they probably, did they speak more Yiddish than English?
Yes, they spoke more Yiddish. I spoke Yiddish as a child. My parents spoke English very, very late and very poorly. And we lived in a part of Brooklyn which was teeming with immigrants, either other people from Eastern Europe, Jews, or Sicilians. And I couldn't tell the difference. I mean, we lived next to the Sicilians, and I had a real, it sounds like coy conceit, but it's a fact. I had a real confusion because right across the hall from us was my best friend at one place we lived, Carmine, and his sisters and brothers and his huge mother and huge father, just across the hall. And I used to run across the hall because they had unkosher food, which is much better, much better than kosher food because it was pasta. It was great Italian cooking. And they laughed and they drank wine and they grabbed me and I sat on their laps and they had a hell of a good time. Then you come back to my house and you have these sober cuisine and not so rambunctious family life. And I really did have a confusion that Italians were happy Jews, that they were a sect.
And
that I would have a choice. That I would have a choice after my bar mitzvah to belong to either the sober sect or the happy sect.
And they went to a different synagogue where they had pasta.
Yeah, I was a dumb kid. Let me tell you. I mean, all the parents looked alike. They all wore the same dull black dresses, and you couldn't tell the difference. Not to me.
This Monday, Maurice Sendak will be honored at the 92nd Street Y to commemorate his recent 80th birthday. In 2003, Terry Gross spoke with Sendak again about his collaboration with playwright Tony Kushner. They adapted a children's opera that originally was performed by children in the Nazi concentration camp Theresienstadt. Sendak designed the sets. The opera, Brundibar, is a parable about evil. It was written in 1938 by a composer who was killed in the gas chambers. Here's the opening scene from a 1992 recording of Brundibar, recorded in Prague.
Thank you.
Terry asked Sendak why the children in the Nazi concentration camp performed the opera Brundibar.
This opera was written by Hans Krause, a very young Czech composer, and it was written for children, Jewish children, in an orphan asylum in Prague to amuse them. It was a contest who could write the prettiest opera for the children. And Krause wrote this, and everybody loved it. And at that very same point, the Nazis entered the country, and the orphanage was emptied, and the children were put into Terezin, the camp. And he was too, as was the librettist. And it became a show camp, became known as Hitler's favorite camp. He set it up in such a way and made a film of how well the Jews were being treated, and the gypsies, and the homosexuals. And this was too, because rumors were getting out that were frightful. And so he set this up to prove to the Red Cross and diplomats who were traveling the world to come by, see a show, and see how happy everybody was. And it's in the film. You see the children singing the last portion of the opera. So they all sat there. It was performed 55 times, a huge success, this little opera, which is about 45 minutes in length. That's the story. Hans Krause was murdered too, as was the librettist, as was, well, mostly everybody in the camp. It was an elitist camp. You had Bauhaus workers there. You had artists, people teaching the children there, intellects. It was a special camp. But so, it ended the same way for all of them.
So the performances were for visiting diplomats to show off the camp?
Yeah,
Do you know if they fell for it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely, they fell for it. The streets were cleaned, trees were planted, all the children were given clean clothes, all the inmates were given clean clothes, everything was swept up, and they went, and you had a pass, quite an attractive pass, which I'd love to have an original of, but I've used as an image in the book, to get in to see Brundibar.
Tell us the story that's told in the opera that you tell in the book.
This was directly written for children, and the limitations of children. They don't have singing voices. Some of them do, but that was by accident. But mostly it's sort of like a Singspiel, which is like a Mozart opera, it's a Singspiel, where you talk over the music rather than actually sing. And those who could sing, sang. And the music is astonishing. He was in his 30s, so you hear Janáček and you hear Weill. And you hear Gershwin and you hear Ravel, and just like all of us young artists steal like crazy until we make ourselves up as artists, you hear all these wonderful sounds. And the story is ultra simple, so the children could follow it and produce the tale, which has to do with a little brother and sister whose mother is ill. And the doctor says unless they get milk for her, she won't last. So they go out into the world, which is, in my case, Prague, into the city proper, and please somebody give them money to buy milk for mommy, and nobody will. And in the streets of Prague, on a specific corner, is Brundibar, who is an organ grinder. Mean. In Czech, Brundibar means bee, like a bee sting. And he's taken over the whole place, and he sings, and people throw money in his hat, and the kids say, well, anybody can do that. So they stand on the other corner and they sing a dreadful song. Everyone just ignores them and they wonder why they can't do this. And they stay all night in the street by themselves and a cat and a bird and a dog come to their assistance and say, look, let's pull this together because the two of you can't do this by yourselves. Let's get all the kids in town. And in the morning there's this beautiful music. The children wake up and they're getting ready to go to school and comb their hair and wash dishes and such. And the animals convince them to come and help these kids. So they all come to the town square, 300 of them. And they say to Brundibar, we want to sing, and we don't care about money. We just want to sing. And Brundibar says, no, get the hell out of here. And then the townspeople say, let the kids do it. And they sing a lullaby, which is like extraordinary to hear it. And people are captivated, and they fill their milk can with coins. They've made it. They have enough money now. But Brundibar sneaks in, grabs the can, rushes off and steals their money. And the whole town chases Brundibar and they catch him and they beat him up. And the kids get their money back and buy the milk, come home triumphant, and save their mama. And that's the story.
But there's an epilogue to the story. There's a little poem at the end. Could you read that
for
us?
Sure.
And just, you know, reminder, this is written while Hitler is coming to power.
Exactly. And the fact that it is impossible for me to doubt that the children knew what their fate was. Imagine standing up on the stage and singing about brotherhood, and if we all hang together, we're going to succeed, and the bully will not. And knowing that as soon as this audience left, kaput, their lives are finished. I can't even grasp that now. I've been studying, working this for over 3 years. Okay, so we're just turning the page on the big happy ending where everything is wonderful and safe and mommy is alive. And then there's a little coda at the end, which was written by Tony, basically. It's not in the opera. And it says, this is Brundibar talking, "They believe they've won the fight. They believe I'm gone. Not quite. Nothing ever works out neatly. Bullies don't give up completely. One departs, the next appears, and we shall meet again, my dears. Though I go, I won't go far. I'll be back. Love, Brundibar."
Yeah, it's kind of chilling.
Yeah, kind of chilling.
Chilling epilogue.
Yeah.
So Tony Kushner wrote that for
the book. He
wrote
that, yeah.
Marie Sendak from a 2003 interview. Let's jump back and hear a little more from his earlier conversation on Fresh Air.
One of the great controversies about your book, is, you know, in the night kitchen, when the character Mickey lands in the batter, he's naked, and mm-hmm. there's this, like, little boy penis that he has, right?
Yeah.
And there were libraries that wouldn't carry the book or would draw little diapers over him, all kinds of silly things like that. I mean, this was not a sexual image. It was just a naked boy image.
Correct.
Right?
I mean, it would have been strange had he not had a penis.
Right.
But no one has ever discussed that problem.
Right.
the astonishing and infuriating business on that book was it's one of my favorite works, and it's a rather complex work. And to have it all reduced, so to speak, to a child's penis is embarrassing. It's silly. And the fact that anyone could carry on about such an issue does not speak well for our culture.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. Now, that book was not about Mickey as a sexual boy or anything. But I think a lot of kids do have sexual feelings, just a little bit older than Mickey. And I was wondering if you ever thought about putting sexual feelings into a children's book, or if that would seem like much too far out.
Well, I have to correct something you say, or at least I don't agree with something you just said, which is that he, little boy, in the night kitchen, does not have sexual feelings. Of course he does. We have them immediately on arrival. There's nothing, in a word, that you can do that is not sexual, so far as I'm concerned. And the creative act is composed of its sexual component. And I don't mean by saying sexual, that is vivid, livid sex. I mean the component of sexuality, sensuality, eroticism is part of everything. And it's what blesses our life. And instead of seeing it in an accusatory way, and I don't mean you, I mean culture in general, or blameworthy way, rather see it for the beautiful thing that it is.
I remember I interviewed you, 8 years ago or something. Something that you said really stuck with me. You were talking about the monsters and where the wild things are, and you were saying that when you were young, the monsters were just adults. There were people with, like, moles on their faces and hairs growing out of their noses.
Yeah.
All
relatives, actually.
Yeah, relatives, exactly. Relative, exactly.
Yeah.
And that really struck a chord. And then I started thinking, well, I'm one of those people now. I mean, I don't know if I actually have hair growing out of my nose, but you know, I have some of those things that I'm sure kind of like scare kids.
Oh, sure.
And do you have your sense of yourself as that too?
Of
like,
course.
You know, a monster to some kids?
Of course I am. I see it in their eyes. When I'm autographing books, which I don't like to do much anymore, and children are shoved at me.
Yeah.
They have no idea why they're on the line. They'd much rather be in the bathroom. And they're standing in line, and they're being told something which is so frightening and confusing, which is being told by mom or dad. This is the man you like so much, honey. This is the man who did your favorite book. And they clutch their book even closer, because that really means he's going to take it away. Because if this is the man's favorite book, then he's going to take your book. And the look of alarm and the tears, and they stare at me like pure hatred. Who is this elderly, short man sitting behind the desk who's going to take their book away? Then on top of that, the parent says, "Now give him your book, honey. He wants to write something in it." Well, there they've been told, don't write in a book. Okay? Why then is it all right for a perfect stranger to write in their book? It's horrible for them. And I become horrible. Unwittingly, I make children cry.
They cry when
they cry when they meet me because they don't know what I'm doing. That's why I've stopped autographing for the most part.
Uh-huh.
For that very, very reason, it's such a paradox that I, who adore them and I'm interested in their welfare, should become their enemy. It's only because it's set up that way. If I'm to visit a school, they're all warned, threatened, and browbeaten for 3 days before I get there. Now I want all of you to be nice, and you must raise your hand, and I want everyone to go to the bathroom before Mr. Sendak comes. I mean, their lives are ruined. So why should I be the person who does that to them?
Oh.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Blues legend B.B. King was born and raised in Indianola, Mississippi, and that southern city hasn't forgotten it. This weekend, the B.B. King Museum and Delta Interpretive Center has its grand opening, featuring artifacts from his 60-year career as a blues guitarist, composer, and singer. King, who is 83, is scheduled to perform Saturday on opening night, and on Sunday, there's a gospel and grits brunch. B.B. King has won 14 Grammys. He's traveled the world, met four presidents and a pope, and was named a living legend by the Library of Congress. Terry Gross spoke to B.B. King in 1996. She asked him how he developed his trademark style of playing single-note guitar as opposed to chords or rhythm.
Well, every time I've worked in a band, I was always featured. And they'd hardly let me play in the rhythm section. Usually, for some reason, most of the players would always say, B, take the solo, take the lead. And I got in the habit of doing that. So I put more emphasis on the single string than I did the chords. I can play a few chords, but I'm no great chord player. But, for example, if you were singing or playing, I could play chords pretty well behind you with a guideline. The guideline mean if I had a bass player or keyboard player, somebody that's playing the chords, I could play then. I could play behind you very well. But other than that, I'm sad. Anybody hear me play by myself, I've just lost that person. You know, they won't listen to me anymore. That's the end.
So did you feel that your strength lay not in just being a guitar player or in just being a singer, but in doing both together?
I think both together. I started to feel that I, you know, had to be a good entertainer to keep a job, and I'm kind of happy that I developed in my head that I'm never any better than my last concert, my last time I played. So it's like an audition each time. Quite often, it's quite a bit like some say when you're going on stage, you have stage fright. In so many words, you get nervous just before going on stage, and I still have that, but I think it's more like concern. You're concerned about the people. It's like meeting your in-laws for the first time.
When I first got the blues, they brought me over on a ship. Men were standing over me, and a lot more with the whip. Man, everybody want to know why I sing the blues. Well, I've been around a long time. I've really paid my dues. I've laid in the ghetto flats, cold and numb. I heard the rats tell the bedbugs to give the roaches some. Everybody wanna know why I'm singing the blues. Yes, I've been around a long time. People, I've paid my dues.
You're from a family of sharecroppers. What was the work that you had to do?
Well, I was a regular hand when I was about seven. I chopped cotton. I picked cotton. I helped to plant it. I did everything that the grown-ups do, and that's mostly the work what had to do with cotton was the king, if you will, of the produce in the Mississippi Delta when I was growing up. Peanuts maybe later, and soybeans later. But cotton still is today one of the main produces that's raised in the Mississippi Delta.
Now, what was the financial arrangement between your family and the plantation owner?
Well, a sharecropper was meant to be exactly what they say, sharecropper. But generally, the boss that owned the plantation did all of the paperwork, if you will. He was the CPA. he did all of that, and he sold the produce that you raised. For example, Jim, you earned, after paying me back the advances I gave you, you made 25 bales of cotton, and the cotton brought maybe $5,000 a bale, and you owed me, say, 25 times that, except maybe $2,000. So here's your $1,800.
You know what I'm wondering? When you were growing up on a plantation, family of sharecroppers, did you vow to yourself early on, I'm getting out of here?
Well, not really. Believe it or not, people lived on the plantation, felt like that this was really home, most of them. And we are being taken care of because the boss of the plantation usually was like your lawyer, your judge, your father, your mom. He was your practically everything. And people lived on the plantation, sort of felt, believe it or not, secure to be there. If they needed a few bucks, usually they could get this from the boss man, and it's taken out at the end of the year. At that time, we didn't have telephones. We didn't have electricity or anything of that sort. Later on, I guess we had electricity maybe a year or so before I left when I was 18 years old. A lot of the people, including myself, the early years, just thought that this was it, you know. This, you raise your families and you get old, die, your families take over, kids and what have you, and it's an ongoing process, if you will. But I somehow later start to feel that there was more for me and a few others. I think it's the same way with young people today. They feel that they're not really happy with the status quo.
It's a great story how you left the plantation. You were driving a tractor. This was a problematic tractor that had it had problems with after ignition. So one day you turned off the tractor, walked out of the tractor, and then the tractor started jumping on its own, rammed into the barn. The exhaust pipe got crushed or, you know, broke off.
Broke off, yes.
And you were afraid of how much money you'd owe the plantation owner.
No, I was afraid that I would be killed.
Oh, even worse.
No. Well, he'd never kill anybody, but he, I don't mean it that way, but scared to death. You know, like if you your mom cooked a cake and you decided that, you know, you're going to get a piece of it and you drop it, you know, and it spills on the floor. Brand new cake that's made for the family, you would feel that mom is going to surely kill you, so you better get out of there. Well, that's the way I felt that the time that the tractor, when it backfired, you know, and ran out of there. It scared me half to death. So I panicked and left, hitchhiked to Memphis. Going from Indianola to Memphis then was like, oh, to me, like leaving Chicago, going to Philly. It was that far. That's the way it seemed at the time. So I was scared to death. I left and stayed for a while and communicated back with my family and my cousin Booker White. Said, go on back there and take your medicine. So I finally went back, and Mr. Barrett was a very nice guy, a man that I admired so much. I wished I could be a lot more like him.
Now, I want to get to another record recorded in 1952. You were 26,
this is a recording of 3 o'clock, 3 o'clock Blues. It had been a hit a few years before for Lowell Folsom.
Right.
This was your first number one record on the R&B charts.
Very first.
You're coming into your own here, don't you think, as a stylist?
I'm a very happy guy to know that somebody told me that I have a hit record. I was very happy to hear that. I think that's music to each performer's ear, to hear that they have a top-selling record or CD.
Let's hear it.
Now it is 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't even close my eyes. Well, I can't find my baby. No, and I can't be satisfied.
That's B.B. King, recorded in 1952. How did that record, your first record, went to number one on the R&B charts, change your life?
Well, it changed my life in many ways. One thing, financially, because I had been making about $60 a week at this radio station. And I would go out and pick cotton. I would drive trucks and tractors. I did everything to try to make ends meet, if you will, because my music wasn't taking care of me. And when I made 3 o'clock Blues, I started then to get guarantees, maybe like $400 or $500 a day when I played out. And that made a big difference, as far as financially speaking, because then I could hire more people to work with me. It made life easier. I could get a driver to keep from having to drive all the different places by myself. I was able to do many things that I hadn't been able to do prior to then.
In the 1950s, you toured on a black music circuit. And you weren't crossing over, even into the early 60s, to white audiences the way other African-American performers who were playing more rock and roll had started to do. Chuck Berry, Little Richard. Did you want to cross over? Were you frustrated that you weren't crossing over?
Well, in the beginning, I was really confused about the way the politics ran. And music, I always thought if you made a good record, it was a good record. If it was a hit record, it was a hit record. And people, not black, not white, red or yellow, but people would like it. Some people would like it. But I learned quickly after I got into the music business that there are so many categories. I was not really wanting to be a crossover, actually, but I wanted all people to hear it and like it. I was hoping, rather, they would like it. And people like Ray Charles, people like Chuck Berry, all these guys to me were very talented, and they was very energetic, Lloyd Price and so on. All of them was very energetic when it come to playing music. They didn't play the slow droopy drawers music like I did, so I found that maybe that was my reason, because they had things that I didn't have, other way musically or entertaining.
In the mid-60s, I guess it was, a lot of the rock guitarists started emulating you. I mean, you became a god to some of them. Mike Bloomfield, Eric Clapton. And that helped introduce your music to college audiences. And then you started playing the college circuit, in addition to the places you'd already been playing. What was it like for you to start playing the college circuit? Did you feel like did it feel very different to you? Did you feel like you needed to change anything about your performance style? Was there anything you were doing that didn't seem to translate?
Yes, I was frightened at first. Here I am, a high school dropout, and I'm going to be playing to college audiences. Yes, I felt that I should wear a hard hat and be Fred Astaire or Nat Cole.
You're real suave.
Yeah. But I remember after 3 o'clock blues, I had a manager, and he told me when I was going, it used to be a saying that for a black performer, it was four theaters you had to play and be accepted before you would be accepted as a true entertainer. One of those theaters was the Howard Theater in Washington, the Royal Theater in Baltimore, and the master itself was the Apollo Theater in New York, in Harlem. By the way, the fourth theater was the Regal Theater here in Chicago. However, my manager said, do not go to New York trying to be Nat Cole or anybody else that's trying to be slick, because there are people that sweep in the floors that are much better than you'll ever be. So the best thing for you to do is go there and be B.B. King.
What good advice.
Sing 3 o'clock blues. Mm-hmm. Sing the song that you sing the way you sing them. He said, now, all these other people can do all of those other things, but they can't be you as you can be you. And that I've tried to keep from then until now.
One of your recordings that I particularly love happens to be a recording with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Your recording of Don't Get Around Much Anymore.
Right.
I mean, gee, you don't even play guitar on this. It's so strange. It's such a unusual recording. I had a field of sing with the Ellington Orchestra. And
frightening.
And not have a guitar. I mean, I don't think
well,
you're playing.
Well, I was afraid to try to sing, and trying to play guitar would have been just too much. But today, I'm more familiar with a lot of the standard tunes, and I would like to try and play the melodies instead of singing them.
Saturday dance. I heard they crowded the floor. It's awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore. I thought I'd visit the club. Got as far as the door. I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore. Darling, I guess my mind is more at ease. But nevertheless, why stir up memories, been invited on dates. I might have gone, but what for? I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore.
I have met over the years a lot of people who've worked with you or toured with you, and it's just not possible, I think, to get anybody to say a bad word about you. I mean, your reputation is of somebody who treats everybody around him really well, with a lot of respect, always fair, financially and in all other ways as well. And I'm just wondering if that's something that you consciously set out to do, I'm not just trying to be nice here. I mean, I think it's just a kind of a fact that you're known for this. I wonder if you think of yourself just naturally Mr. Nice Guy, or if it's something that you've felt really obliged to do and have been very conscious about doing.
There are some things that I've read that I truly believe in. I believe that one should treat others as they want to be treated. And that's one of the things that I try to live by, if you will, is trying to be fair to people as I want them to be to me.
B.B. King, it's really been such a delight to talk with you. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. You're very kind to talk with. I enjoy your voice.
B.B. King, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. The B.B. King Museum and Delta Interpretive Center opens this weekend in his hometown, Indianola, Mississippi. In April, Joel and Ethan Coen won Academy Awards for writing and directing their 12th feature film, the violent and bleak thriller No Country for Old Men. Their 13th film is violent, too, but Burn After Reading also is a gleeful farce. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Burn After Reading is a burlesque of paranoid conspiracy films like Syriana, with the same lead, George Clooney, as the biggest of its buffoons. The movie is a boisterous doodle, and it's a little thin, but it's fun to think about in light of Joel and Ethan Coen's pet theme, tunnel vision. In their films, people act out of such narrow self-interest, they become, as the title of the Coen's first feature spells out, blood simple. No one sees the whole picture, except the audience, which laughs at the monkey shines, or in the case of No Country for Old Men, gasps at the cruelty. No Country, adapted from Cormac McCarthy, gave the Coen's cynicism weight. God had left the field. Chaos ruled. Stooges died meaningless deaths. I found it almost too upsetting, and it must have been a workout for the Coens as well, because it turns out they wrote Burn After Reading simultaneously, going back and forth between, literally, the sublime and the ridiculous. The brothers are masters at taking found objects, clichés, genre tropes, and mixing them into a uniquely Coensian fruitcake. Here, they open with the camera plunging from a satellite view of Earth to CIA headquarters while drums pound portentously. An intelligence analyst, played by John Malkovich, is brusquely demoted, and we're cued by the somber setup to think he's too good at his job and has tread on higher-ups' toes. But it turns out his demotion is because he's a total lush. Now he says he will have his revenge. He'll pen a memoir that exposes the agency's inner workings. When his computer disk, full of rambling notes, turns up in the locker room of his health club, a pair of employees, played by Frances McDormand and Brad Pitt, become inept blackmailers. And I won't say more, because the narrative is such a labyrinth of idiocy that part of the fun is getting lost. There are lots of in-jokes. Clooney plays a federal marshal who gets sucked into the plot. He's involved with Tilda Swinton as Malkovich's frosty wife. And Clooney, who got the better of Swinton in Michael Clayton, is here her inferior, a twitchy sex addict with one-tenth the charisma of, say, George Clooney. McDormand's character is obsessed with plastic surgery and whines to Richard Jenkins as her lovelorn boss in a way that I'm sure bears some relation to her own career.
I need those surgeries, Ted.
You're a beautiful woman. You don't need
I have gone just about as far as I can go with this body.
I think it's a beautiful... It's not a phony baloney Hollywood body.
That's right, Ted. I would be laughed out of Hollywood. I have very limited breasts, a ginormous ass, and I've got this gut that swings back and forth in front of me like a shopping cart with a bent wheel.
You know, there's a lot of guys that like you just the way you are.
Yeah, losers.
I don't know. I mean, am I a loser?
Oh, Ted.
You know, I wasn't always a manager at Hard Bodies. Let me tell you,
Jenkins's nebbishy contortions are exquisite, and McDormand is all revved up and having a jolly time. So is Brad Pitt as a muscled-up but sweet boob who attempts to make a deal with Malkovich for the return of his CIA memoir notes.
Let me explain something to you.
What you're engaged in is blackmail. That is a felony, that's for starters.
I'm a mere good Samaritan.
Secondly, the unauthorized dissemination of classified material is a federal crime. If you ever carried out your proposed threat, you would experience such a storm of consequences, my friend, that your empty little head would be spinning faster than the wheels of your Schwinn bicycle back there.
You think that's a Schwinn?
I love Malkovich's escalating hysteria there. But for all its amusing curlicues, Burn After Reading is basically a one-joke movie, and it feels long even at 90 minutes. That the characters are fools and nothing is at stake is the comic point, but it's hard to shake the idea that the Coens are on autopilot. Their great comedy, The Big Lebowski, was a genre burlesque, too, of Raymond Chandler, but its stoner antihero, played by Jeff Bridges, had a weird stature that transcended the premise, and there was so much loopy invention, you didn't have time to get bored. Here, the only surprises are a couple of bloody deaths that seem to belong in another film. Burn After Reading suggests it's not enough to set clowns on collision courses. The filmmakers have to have some emotional stake in the outcome. In No Country for Old Men, they clearly lamented the waste of life. Here, they seem to give a little shrug and say, oh well. And so, in the end, do we.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.